Welcome to Northern Goal, the football podcast from the Evening Express and Press and Journal. I'm Ryan Crile, and today I'm joined by Paul Third and Callum Law. But we're not alone. Joining us today is Scotland international, Hibs ladies star, Northfield Academy alumni, I'm not sure. Rachel Boyle, how is everyone?
Hiya.
Hi, I'm fine, good, thanks.
All right. Okay, so Rachel, you've kindly agreed to talk us through your life and career today. First of all, we need to ask you, how's the lockdown been? I guess you're probably in Edinburgh.
I am, yeah. I'm based down here now. So it's actually been okay for us, surprisingly. I thought it was going to be quite difficult, but I've managed to convert the garage into a makeshift gym. So that's kind of been my escape and everyday life. So yeah, looking forward to getting back to normality now, but it's been okay.
Not to assume, but I reckon you've probably been spending quite a lot of time looking after your daughter. Is it in that way a sort of a blessing in disguise for you and your husband that you're getting to spend all this time together?
Yeah, I think it has actually, because since the moment she was born, one of us has been away from her most of the time. So to have us both there full time for 3 months, she's kind of got used to having us there. So I don't know what it's going to be like when we both have to start going back to work. But so far, so good.
Can I ask if you're perhaps a touch jealous that your husband Martin's been able to return to training in the last week or so?
I think I am, actually. Yeah, he's getting to escape out the house for a few hours and get his own freedom back. So yeah, I'm looking forward to the women's game starting back up whenever it gets the chance. But no, for him, it's great for him to get back out there. And I think for his sanity as well, he needs to be back on a football pitch.
Do you have a date to even look forward to, Rachel?
No, we haven't heard, actually. I think the last we heard, the league are still trying to discuss with all the clubs when it would be feasible to get back in. And it's obviously safety first. So a lot of the women's teams can't really afford the testing that the men can. So it's not even looking likely that it'll be anytime soon. But fingers crossed something can happen and we can get out of this lockdown a bit sooner than planned and get back going again.
Is there maybe a worry, Rachel, potentially that the season has to just sort of be written off in the women's game?
Yeah, I mean, there's always that doubt. We have no idea what the best plan going forward is going to be, because obviously we were only one game into our season this year. So it might be that they just scrap this season. I think there's been talk that we might actually start back up again October, November time, and just play round robin and finish in May and then have a month's break in the summer and then start again in tandem with the men's season, which is something that we haven't done for a few years. So there's always that option as well. So I think it's just what's best for every team in the league. And obviously there's going to be some disagreements there with the best way forward, but that's not really for the players to decide. So we're just waiting to hear.
At the risk, Rachel, of getting a touch political here, there's been a lot in the national media about when on the men's side, the leagues like League One and League Two will be able to start up here, when the Highland League will be able to start. Do you feel to an extent in that national narrative the women's side of things has perhaps been forgotten about a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the national media, it's always men first and then the women's game second sort of thing. So it's something that we're used to. Obviously, we want to try and change that. And I think we were changing that before the lockdown and everything came about. The national team was doing well and there was starting to be a bit more publicity in the women's game, but we're kind of going back to square one now. So yeah, we just need to keep kicking on and hopefully we can, as I say, get out of this lockdown and start progressing with both the national team and the current domestic league as well, which was planning on going at least semi-professional for some teams. So we'll wait and see what happens.
You're mentioning sort of the national team there, Rachel. Given, you know, all the sort of good work and everything that was done, I suppose, last year with being at the World Cup and everything and the sort of spotlight that shone on the women's game, is it, I suppose it's disappointing, is it, you know, that momentum that the game was building up sort of been halted a wee bit?
Yeah, I think you mentioned it now, the momentum that the team had built in terms of publicity and being in the media and having really good results since the World Cup, it's kind of been a bit disappointing that everything's just grinded to a halt. Especially from my own perspective, I managed to just get back into the team and I thought I'd done quite well when we were in Spain there. So to come home and everything's just completely stopped, it's been a hard one to take, but everyone's in the same boat and we're just looking at the best way possible for moving forward. And obviously, as we say it, safety first, and everyone's got to look after themselves and their families. So That's the priority at the moment, and unfortunately the football's got to take the back seat.
Okay, Rachel, so what we'll do now is we'll go all the way back to the start and then work our way back to Hibs in Scotland and what's going to happen in the future for you. Can you tell us maybe first of all how you got into football at the first place? Was that at Northfield or was that before Northfield Academy?
No, I was really young. I was about 3 or 4, and my dad started running my older brother's football team. So my mum worked at weekends and I didn't have anyone to look after me. So my dad says, right, you're just going to come along with me and your brother to his football and his training. So I went along, and the first couple of times I sat at the side and just passed the ball about at the side. And then as I started to get a little bit older, I started to join in with the older boys and things. And I loved it. I loved playing in the garden with my brother and his friends. And it's something that I've always done since a young age. With my mum working, I had no option really but to go along. So it's either join in and enjoy it or sit at the side and be bored. So it's something that I loved. And yeah, that's how it started. I got involved with my brother and joined into his team, and then eventually found my own team with my own age group.
What team was it you played for at club level?
It was Stonywood Boys Club.
Obviously, you then go on to progress. I know you played quite a lot of age group national football, but you were also part of the North Regional Football Academy, the SFA's setup, where that allowed you to sort of after school continue training and also studying for a degree as well.
Yeah, by the time I joined that, I'd left school. I left school at 17, I think it was. I went straight into work. I never went on to extended study or anything like that. So I was working full time at that point, and they asked me to join. So I was actually going to training first thing in the morning at the sports village at about, I think it was 7 o'clock in the morning till 8. And then I was hopping it in the shower and then getting straight to work and starting work at 9. So yeah, it was pretty full on. We'd done that 3 times a week. And then that allowed us to stay in the fold with the national team and get the extra training that the national team were looking for at that time for their top players.
What you're speaking about there, Rachel, it sounds, well, it is a big commitment to be doing that before you're even, you know, starting the day job. But I suppose, is it just that love of the game and, you know, wanting to be involved with playing for your country that drives you on to make those commitments?
Yeah, I think for me, it was definitely the drive of getting selected for the national team. At that time, it was basically, if you weren't doing the extra training, you weren't able to keep up with the players that had went full-time down in England and abroad. So for me, I had to be getting those sessions in so that I could compete with the best players, not only in our country, but across the world. So yeah, it was a no-brainer that's something that I had to do. And I think it definitely benefited me at the time, but there came a point in time where enough was enough and I couldn't keep up, so that had to slow down a bit.
In your teenage years, do you remember coming across all the players that have gone on to play at a similar level to you, the Corsairs and the Kim Littles of this world?
Yeah, I remember we first met Kim Little up at in Inverness. I think it was regional training up there. We used to travel up there every second Wednesday for a couple of hours of training with the regional squad up there, and came across Kim, and you just knew she was a top player. Everything that she did was first class, and we used to play bounce games against boys teams up there, and you can remember hearing the boys the first couple of weeks, they think they're big time and they think they can beat you, and then as soon as they came up against Kim, they very quickly went back into their shell. So yeah, she was a first class player and a first class person as well. So it's something that playing alongside these types of players, your Corsairs and your Kims, yeah, it definitely makes you better as a player.
How did you go on to end up playing for Aberdeen for a start? Obviously, you've had two spells at Aberdeen, but how did you end up in that setup and start looking towards, I suppose, not perhaps a career at that point, but a sort of lifetime in the club game at the top level?
Well, I actually joined Aberdeen Ladies when I became too old to play with the boys. I played with the boys right up through my childhood. Didn't really know of any girls teams at the time. It's not something that I even paid much attention to, the fact that there was women's football and men's football at the time. So I just played with boys right through, didn't really think anything else of it. And then I think it was at 14 or something, that's the cut-off age where you're too old to play with the boys and you have to go and play with the girls. So At that point, I had to find a girls team, and luckily enough, Aberdeen had known about me, so they had came in contact with me and my dad, and I went along to my first training session and gelled with the girls instantly. So from there, I played about a season, I think, at Aberdeen under 17 level at that point. And the ladies manager very quickly promoted me to the Premier team. And from there, I've been in the SWPL since then. So
just to backtrack a wee bit, Rachel, you said when you get to 14, you're told you can't play with the boys anymore. At that age, is that quite sort of, you know, if that's all you've really known, is that quite difficult to take, you know, to be told that you can't play with people that you've been playing with or against for a good few years?
Yeah, it was a hard one to take, because obviously that was my friends, that was who I'd grew up playing football with, and for me to be told that I wasn't allowed to play with them anymore, but they could all carry on playing together, it was tough to take, and it was something that I didn't really enjoy, because I couldn't understand why I wasn't allowed to play with them. It's not until you get a little bit older that you start to realise why. But yeah, I mean, at the time, I kind of knew that the boys were getting a little bit faster and a little bit stronger than I was, and they were progressing physically a lot quicker than I was. So I knew that there was going to come a time where I just wasn't going to be as good coming up against the same players. So yeah, to then step into the women's game, I think it definitely helped me playing with the boys, because I knew that I had the speed and the physicality to compete in the women's game. So it was a big adjustment, but it was one that I can understand why it has to be done. Because looking back now, there's no way you would get a female player at the top of her game competing with your Kevin De Bruyne's and things like that. There's just no chance. But it's a completely different game. So yeah, that's the differences between the men's and women's side for me.
Based on what you said there, Rachel, though, and I've had this discussion with other players, that do you feel that that experience has made you the player you are, though, the fact that you were playing with the boys at a younger age, and obviously now you've got a situation where the girls' game has grown and there'll be girls coming through that never play with the boys. Do you think that's perhaps a disadvantage to them, that they're not getting that experience, so they're maybe the rougher side of the game, I suppose, is where the men's game differs, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me growing up, that was all I knew. So going into the boys' game, that's just what you had to do at that time. But for now, for girls coming through, I don't think they necessarily need to be playing with the boys, because the women's game has come on so much that there is a lot of talented players and talented coaches in the women's game that are going to progress these young girls into top players. I've no doubt about that. But for my side of things, it definitely molded me as a player, because I knew that I had to try and compete with all these boys that maybe turned their nose up at me and said, oh, they've got a girl in their team and we need to beat them, we can't get beat from this lot because there's a girl there. So for me, that was added motivation to prove them wrong and show that I could actually compete with them. And I can still remember to this day, we played a cup final against Dice, and at the time I was playing for the Northfield Boys Club, and we were in the second division, and Dice were obviously top team, and they were the top of the first division. So we turned up to this cup final, complete underdogs, and Graham Shinney was actually playing for Dice. And we took them all the way to penalties. I think it finished 1-1 after extra time, and we took them to pens. And I stepped up to take a penalty, and Graham Shinney's dad was standing next to my dad, and he had shouted across saying, don't let this little blonde such and such score a penalty. And I put it in the back of the net, and we ended up winning the cup final. And yeah, to this day, it was people like that that I had to try and prove wrong in the men's game. So I think I'd done that more often than not.
That was the kind of anecdote we wanted you on to give us. Perfect. Sorry, everyone, by the way, if you heard a new voice on the podcast there.
That must be our first ever canine, our first canine guest on.
You're joking, he's on every week. Okay, so. So you touched on, Rachel, there how the game's progressed to the point where there is girls' teams and things, but at the level you've been playing at the Premier League level, you've obviously played for Aberdeen, you've played for Forfar, back to Aberdeen, and now you're at Hibs. How has the Premier League progressed over the time you've played in it, would you say?
I think it's got much more competitive. When I first joined the Premier League, we were obviously playing for Aberdeen, and to be honest, we were never the best team. We used to travel down to Glasgow on a weekly basis and get annihilated. It wasn't enjoyable for anyone. But now, looking back, I think when I signed again to Aberdeen, we were a lot more competitive and things had really grown. And we got, I think it was our highest ever finish in the league, which we just got pipped to third, I think it was, by Celtic on the last day, which was a bit controversial that day. So yeah, the competitiveness of the league, there's teams right across the league that are getting stronger, getting better qualities of play in. And yeah, I think we're really starting to push now. Although Glasgow City are still winning the league year in, year out, I think you can look at the rest of the results and see that teams are capable of taking points off each other. So now it's just about bridging that gap with Glasgow City now.
I mean, in terms of your time at Hibs as well, Rachel, you've also had a fair bit of success with the cups you've won in that. Is that maybe the next step that you'd like to try and take, is to push Glasgow City over a whole league campaign?
Yeah, I think that's always been the aim, especially the last 3-4 years since I've been at Hibs. We always want to try and topple Glasgow City and get that league title. That's the one thing in Scotland that I haven't won, and I would love to win it one day, but time is running out, so it needs to be done pretty soon. But yeah, Glasgow City are a top team, and as everyone can see, they're doing so well in Europe and get to the last eight, which is no mean feat. So yeah, it's going to be a tough one to do, but something that I know that Hibs are capable of, and even other teams that have developed and obviously came on. You've got your Rangers and your Celtics who have thrown money into their clubs as well and improved their women's teams. So they'll be a challenge as well once we get back up and running from lockdown.
Rachel, what is it that makes Glasgow City the benchmark for everyone else? What sets them apart?
I think it's their mentality. They don't take losing lightly at all. They've got some pros in their team that have been there for years, and they know the club like the back of their hand, and they do not let standards drop at all. From what I hear, when players go in to train with them, training as could be more fierce than a game for some players when they walk in. I don't think any of the older players hold back on the young ones, and they really step them up and give them that winning mentality from the get-go, and I think that breeds throughout the team. You'll see them still pushing on in the last minutes of games. If we're pushing them in a close game with Hibs, they're still there and thereabouts. And I think the Scottish Cup final last year epitomised Glasgow City. We obviously came back from behind and led the game, and they scored 2 goals in the last 20 minutes. Like, that's Glasgow City. They don't take no for an answer, and they don't lie down to anyone. So that's what makes them difficult to play against and certainly difficult to beat.
Do you think, Rachel, part of it is obviously Hibs, I think at the start of the season, Joel Murray, a part-time professional contract?
Yeah.
Is that right? And do you think that's what it's going to take for teams to an extent to, because I know Glasgow City have got pros to, you know, almost have these full-time players that are sort of have nothing else, you know, to occupy or distract them, to really rein in their ongoing success?
I think they've had that for a couple of seasons now, where they've had a core group of players at Glasgow City who are on full-time contracts. For Hibs, we're just starting to kind of break that mould and get in, and obviously seeing the semi-professional contracts get set up, it was just more this season. So obviously the season's been halted, and it's something that we're hoping to get back to, and fingers crossed the club can keep it all running and keep it semi-professional. Otherwise, we are going to lose more players to full-time contracts. It's inevitable. It's at the end of the day, girls are now wanting to play football as a career. So if they get the offer of going somewhere and making a living out of it, they're obviously going to take it. So for us to keep competing at the top end, we need that investment into the club and to try and attract the best players, which we have managed to do in the past because we've been a top team. But going forward, I think more and more the money and financial side of things is starting to creep into the women's game. So we'll just have to see how things progress.
I suppose as well, Rachel, what in terms of away from football, what sort of jobs have you worked in outside the game?
Well, I've always done the same thing since I left school. I went into, I started off as an office junior in a legal firm, and they quickly promoted me to a legal secretary. So I've always been a legal secretary since I left school. And even when I moved down to Edinburgh and I was looking for a new job, luckily enough, there was one in East Lothian that came up and I managed to get it. So for me, I've known nothing else but office work since I've left school. And obviously football is my escape, and I come out of my work and go and run about a pitch for 90 minutes and then go back to normality. So for me, it's quite a nice escape for me, and I'm not football full-time 100% of the week. So, but obviously, girls growing up now, they have that ambition to then go and play full-time professional football, which if I was growing up in this day and age, I would have been the exact same as them. So
I was going to ask, how much of a challenge is that between the work balance and the football career? Because obviously, you, like you've mentioned, you were away to Spain. How does that work with the employer? Do you go, oh, by the way, I need a few days off, I'm going away to play football in Spain?
Yeah, it can be quite difficult. Years ago, when I first got involved with the national team, and my employer was really good up in Aberdeen, he allowed me to go away and play for the team, but I did have to use my holidays. And then once they were all used up, I then had to take unpaid leave, but he still allowed me to go. So at the time, I didn't really have anything else in my life but football and work. So I was quite happy to do that, but I didn't have a summer holiday for about 6-7 years, I don't think. And then coming down to Edinburgh and having a family and stuff, obviously I need to balance it a lot better. So my employer is still really good. He'll give me time off, but I am only working part-time since the birth of my daughter, so I'm only needing 2 days off a week now rather than the five. So it is a lot easier to try and balance football with work when you're not working as many days of the week, I suppose. So,
but you spoke about that even when you first got into the national team, Rachel, and not having holidays and things. Is that do you think the sort of, you know, sacrifices that people like yourself have been making, you know, to play for Scotland, that probably goes, you know, unnoticed really to the general public?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, when all your friends are flying off to your Ayanapas and your Magalufs and your Ibizas and things, and you're sitting at home because you have to fly to Poland or something to go and play against Poland in a few months' time, it's quite hard to take because you feel a bit left out from your friends and the social side of your life. But at the same time, there's nothing better than pulling on a Scotland shirt and representing your country against some of the best teams in the world. So for me, it was a no-brainer. I've never really been a party girl who wants to go out drinking and just getting in all sorts with your friends. But for me, yeah, football was always my main priority. And my friends that appreciated that have always been really supportive, and they've always been there for me. So when I do go home and I get some time off, they're always keen to meet up and we'll catch up from there. But yeah, football always was the number one priority for me. And if I missed a summer holiday here or there, then that's something that I had to do just to be able to represent my country.
Rachel, you said earlier that you hope that when all of this crisis is behind us, that Hibs will still be in a position to push on in the way they were planning to start the season.
Mm-hmm.
With the owner, Ron Gordon, talking publicly about the need to sort of tighten things up and steady the ship. Has that been something in the last few days that's been the women's team's been aware of, that's been fed through and communicated to the women's team?
I mean, we've been on weekly Zoom calls with the team, and our coaches have come on a couple of times as well, just to kind of update us on the situation behind the scenes and things. For us, what happens with the men's team has no reflection of what's going to happen to the women's team. We're a completely separate company. We're actually based under the Hibs Community Foundation and not actually Hibernian Football Club. So everything that we get then comes from the foundation. So ours is more of a fundraising kind of community spirit thing. So for us, we're just kind of waiting from the top boss at the Community Foundation to hear what's going to be happening. But as far as we know, everything's going to be as is. So when we come back to training, it'll just be like back to normality again for us. So that's the situation that we've been told so far. And if anything changes, then I'm sure they'll tell us about it.
Just before we move on to a bit more in-depth talk about Scotland and hopes for the future, obviously Rangers, Celtic have been making a bit of a sort of concerted effort to try and upset the balance in the top flight. Aberdeen as well, obviously they're in the second tier, but they are hoping to get back up into the top league soon. Does that worry you? Is it a good challenge to know that there could be other teams coming in that will be trying to fight for those pieces of silverware?
Yeah, I think it's only going to benefit the women's game, I think, if it becomes more competitive, then there's going to be more interest in it. And especially with the development of Rangers and Celtic, who are massive, massive clubs in the men's game. So if they can lure some of their men's team supporters onto their women's side, yeah, that's only going to improve the league spectacle as well. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of Old Firm fans that are going to pay attention to the women's derbies and things. So yeah, it's something to look forward to. I think Aberdeen are pushing and really trying their best to get back into the top league as well, which is where they need to be as a club. They've definitely got the facilities now with the training facilities and things that they've just built up there. So yeah, get these teams back into the league and make it as competitive as possible. And I'm sure that the media interest will grow and the fans' interest will grow. And yeah, it can only go from strength to strength.
Okay, so Scotland. Obviously, you're back in the setup at the moment. Is going to a major tournament with Scotland, having watched the last couple, I'm sure, is that a big career ambition for you going forward?
Yeah, it is now that I'm a bit older. Past tournaments gone past, I kind of knew, obviously, the Euros. I wasn't even involved in the squad building up to the Euros. So I knew that I was never ever going to go to that one, and I'd made peace with that. At the time, I wasn't really involved with the whole setup at all for a good few years prior to that. So yeah, and then leading into the World Cup, I'd obviously fell pregnant with my daughter and things. So that one was a tough one to take, because I thought if I wasn't pregnant, would I have had a chance? And but at the same time, I would never change my daughter for the world. So yeah, I had something else to concentrate on at the time, but now that I've had her and the family situation's all settled, I'm kind of really trying to push on now and really stake a claim for trying to get into this Euros.
Once you were pregnant with your daughter Rachel, did you maybe sort of think in terms of international football that was, you'd maybe had your time, or did you always think, you know, once she was born and everything, and once you were back playing, that you could get back in the national setup?
I never thought about the national setup. I kind of thought to myself when I did fall pregnant that maybe my international career was done and there was no chance of me getting back in, because as I say, leading up to that, I hadn't really been in it that much when I fell pregnant. I'd only been in a couple of times since Shelley came into the manager. So for me, I was a bit wary, thinking, well, that could be me done. But at the same time, I thought to myself, well, I've done it. Nobody can take that away from me. So I could be proud of myself for having my Scotland caps. I'd always said to everyone that I was going to come back to playing football after my daughter. I always wanted to get fit again and carry on playing for as long as I could. But I never put any pressure on myself to say that I definitely want to be back in the national team, because that's not for me to decide. That's for the manager. So luckily for me, I've managed to get myself fit and get myself playing again and really staked a claim for the team, and Shelley's obviously seen what she liked and she brought me back in. So yeah, lockdown couldn't have came at a worse time for me, really.
Rachel, we're always going to touch on this, but it was pretty high profile when you came back. You were sort of given this role model status in the media, obviously coming back to lift a trophy with Hibs, getting the last 32 of the Champions League. You were on the front of the Hibs programme, I believe you're the first woman to ever have that honour. Mm-hmm. And then you got back in the Scotland squad. Can you give us an insight into how it is to come back from having a child to get to the level where you can take part in elite sport again? How difficult is that? That comeback route?
There was a lot of tears. it's very difficult. I don't think I realised quite how difficult it was going to be. Obviously, I'd never went through childbirth before and pregnancy or anything. So to come back and kind of, it was a bit of an unexpected. The only players that I had known that had done the same thing was Julie Fleeton and Suzanne Grant, and they're obviously older than I was. And to be honest, although I speak to them, I'm not that close, so I didn't really know how they felt coming through their comebacks. So for me, it was a bit of an unknown. I was just kind of going at it every day. And I think having a wedding dress to try and fit into as well kind of gave me that added motivation to get fitter quicker. So every spare minute of the day, I was out training and trying to get fit and lose the weight. So to come back and win a trophy as quickly as I did with Hibs, it was the icing on the cake, really. And then obviously for Shelley to contact me about getting back into the national team, it was it made all the tears and all the down days and the dark days worth it, really. It's something that I would go through again if it led to the same outcome.
Do you feel as if you appreciated more, I don't want to say a second time round, but post-birth, for example, is it?
Yeah, I think having your daughter at the side of the pitch whenever you're playing, it kind of gives you that sense of pride and something that you really want to do, not only for yourself, but for her and for your family, and to come off the pitch. And even if you've had an absolute shocker of a game and you see her running across to you with a big smile on her face because she's getting to see her mummy again, it kind of just puts everything else into perspective and makes you realise that there is life away from football, although you want to win every game. But yeah, if you have a bad day and you come home to her smiling and running about the house, it kind of just makes everything that little bit better.
Do you think, Rachel, that the sacrifice is appreciated enough, the fact that for women in sport, if they want to have a child, unlike men who can, they can have a child while also continuing their career as an athlete, for a woman it means basically making a personal decision that takes away a slice of time from your professional career as an athlete, or your career as an elite athlete. If you then want to have another child, say you're basically, you know what it's like, you know how much time it's going to take away from your limited playing career. Do you think that sacrifice, as I said, is appreciated enough?
I think it's appreciated by the people that have went through it and their families and things. So for me, obviously, Martin obviously plays football as well, and that's his career. So I feel like he really appreciated the fact that I had to put my career on hold in terms of football, but he never. So I think he realised how difficult it was for me to come along and sit in the stands and watch him for a year and a half, and for myself not to be at that level. It's a hard one to take, but it happens to women across the board. It's not just in sport. If women at the top of their career and in their professional lives, if whether they're climbing the ladder at a business or whatever, it happens right across the board. So for me, it's something that I certainly felt appreciated in terms of my family and my support system. And I would like to think that other players that go through it will have the same support. In terms of the media, it's something, again, that it's more male-based football that the media go towards. So yeah, there wasn't that much in terms of women's stories and for coming through with the players and things. So yeah, that was my story in terms of being able to have a child, but also put my career on hold. But now looking forward, it's just all about appreciating the time that I've got left in terms of my sport.
Is your daughter going to be the greatest footballer of all time, given her parents?
If I show you a video of her trying to kick a ball into the goal, I'll say no. But she isn't two yet, so I'm going to kind of give her some leeway there and realise that she is still only little. So hopefully she'll get better with a bit of practice. But we do have her with a football and goals, and every time she scores a goal, we make a big deal of it to try and get her to keep doing it. So we shall see. Time will tell.
Okay, thank you very much, Rachel.
Wait a minute.
Callum, on you go.
I know.
on that front as well, Rachel, who would you say is better at encouraging her or coaching her, you or Martin?
Well, we haven't really got to that stage yet. I think her dad would love her to play football. I've always said that I would never ever force her into it. I would like her to play it. But we have had a few disagreements about what national team she will represent if she is that good. So we'll have to wait and see where it goes from there. But yeah, I think her dad is super supportive of her, and he's the one that's thrown her in the air whenever she scores a goal. And she's definitely a daddy's girl when it comes to playtime, because I can't get a minute with her. She's always by her dad's side. So yeah, we'll have to see her dad when it comes to that side of things.
You better watch she doesn't pick up Martin's Australian accent, eh?
His Australian accent is about as good as my Irish, honestly.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Rachel, for talking us through your career and other things. I hope you can stick with us while we discuss in the next section some of the other news affecting clubs in the north at the moment. Okay, so it's been another interesting week in Scottish football, so to speak. The Hearts and Park Thistle legal challenge. The latest development is that Dundee United, Raith Rovers and Cove Rangers could be stripped of their promotions if the legal challenge is successful. Guys, are we all in agreement that that would be totally unfair?
Did you not just say last week, that's the end of it?
Yeah.
Would it be unfair? Would it be unfair? I don't know. I mean, I've spent the last however many weeks it's been saying there's no fair way of deciding this, but I can actually see the logic in the argument Hearts and Partick are making, which might come as a shock. Is it unfair? Yes. Unlikely? I don't know. A legal challenge from Hearts and Partick can be summed up as this. By all means, decide the winners of the leagues, but promotion and relegation doesn't have to be the consequence of those decisions when the competitions have not been officially completed. I think that's what their legal argument's going to be. If Hearts, Partick and Shinra's argument is that no club should be penalised, then it stands to reason that no club should be rewarded either. That's what they're saying. I can see where they are going with that one when you think about it that way. But and the key for me on this one is, can they successfully argue that point when clubs themselves have voted to end the season? It is interesting to see how that one's going to stand up to legal scrutiny.
I mean, I'm no barrister by any stretch, but...
We've called you things close to that word before.
Aye, aye. Maybe with one less R, but...
Barista.
I just don't understand how they can justify... I mean, it's an interesting argument, but how they can say that their Hearts and Partick Thistle's need or justification for not being relegated is greater than the justification that particularly Dundee United and Cove have for being promoted when they were 14 and 13 points clear respectively. And I mean, Willie Miller's saying he's same in his Evening Express column today that to him it doesn't sit right that a team that's done everything right to be miles clear at the top of the league should then be denied promotion when, okay, the seasons have finished early, but Hearts and Partick Thistle ultimately have been very poor over a consistent period of time. And he was sort of saying that that needs to be the need to address that somewhere along the line, because it can't just be a case of always blaming everyone else. So I would kind of be in agreement with that as well, because I think fairness has gone out the window ultimately, given some of the stuff that's gone on over the last couple of months. But it does seem unfair to me on the sides that would be denied promotion.
Do we think the outcome is going to be that Hearts and Partick just get a financial settlement and it all just goes away? I know the clubs will probably have to share that among themselves because the SPFL probably doesn't have the cash reserves, but is that the most straightforward way forward at this point?
But the clubs are the SPFL. If the SPFL doesn't have that money, then I'm pretty confident the clubs don't either. I mean, I haven't taken the time to studiously go through the SPFL rules, but I'm guessing somewhere in there, written in black and white, it says the team that wins the league goes up and the team at the bottom goes down. I'm not sure if it might specifically say it after X amount of games. If you're honouring one part by promoting Dundee United, Raith Rovers and Cove Rangers, someone has to give up their place in Turin. That's the crux of this. I haven't heard a word said against the league winners being promoted until a week ago when the legal action started. But now that reconstruction is not happening, we're back at square one and clubs are out of desperation. They're trying to protect their own interests. I don't blame any club for doing that, but this has become a huge mess and I really don't know if that fictional 10 million figure even exists.
I'd be interested, Rachel, to get your reading of it, given you said you're a legal secretary, so are you maybe able to give us a better understanding of the whole thing?
Unfortunately, I deal with the house purchases and sales, so I can't really give you much legal terms in that. But yeah, I agree with the guys. It's pretty clear that if they've backed the Cove Rangers and Dundee United and everyone for promotion, I can't see why they can then go and fight the case of not allowing teams to go down. I think the league reconstruction idea might have been a good way to try and make all parties happy. But yeah, I can totally understand why clubs are now starting to look out for themselves and do what's best for them. But at the same time, the whole thing is just an absolute shambles and it's kind of making a mockery of the Scottish game in terms of everyone from the outside looking in. It's just a disaster at the moment.
I think the whole reason as well that we've reached this point with legal action is that everyone has been looking after themselves and not really look, or the majority anyway, because I mean, it's been spoken about to death really, but I mean, 16 out of the 42 clubs voting for reconstruction really was a sad indictment on in terms of trying to do what was best for the greater good of the game, really, that couldn't even get off the ground.
You're right. Without league reconstruction, there isn't, I can hear Johnny Hayes in the background. Without league reconstruction, there isn't a way in which we can get through this without somebody being hurt. Now we just need to decide, well, who's going to be hurt?
Okay. Rachel, I'm sure Edinburgh is a powder keg at the moment, as always. Goes on. We teased it a little bit there accidentally, but Johnny Hayes has today completed his return to Aberdeen finally after what, 2 weeks of speaking about that, was it, Thardy?
Oh, yeah. At least.
I mean, we've kind of said it already, haven't we? But obviously, the majority will think that's a really good piece of business for Aberdeen early in the summer.
I hope so. I mean, I said it last week, I think Johnny will probably be one of the biggest signings for any club out with the big two in Scottish football this summer, just given his track record. And it's great to see him back at Aberdeen. That's how I feel about it. I think there was a slight delay just in terms of trying to get things like scans and that done, given the current challenges that we seem to have with getting access to medical facilities during this coronavirus. Johnny's a very good player, who's going to make a huge contribution to Aberdeen.
I would echo what you're saying, Thirdy. I think there's no doubt about his ability, and I think being realistic, he's probably, unless they're able to maybe dip into the loan market at a later date, you know, once the season started or something, I think being realistic, he's probably going to be the only signing of the summer, isn't he?
I think so. I don't see much more happening in terms of coming in. The Dons are running with a big squad as it is. In terms of Johnny himself, I don't think we need Sherlock Holmes to tell us that he's taken a substantial financial hit to make this move happen. That would have been the case
right
before
the release, Paul.
I know. Well, you're reading it. I'm working. That would have been the case before the club's announcement of beginning talks with the staff about temporary wage cuts last week. I'm sure it's just had an added impact on it now, and it's probably why it's taken just a few days more to get over the line. He will have been on substantial wages at Celtic in comparison to what the Dons can offer. But it does speak volumes of Johnny's desire that he just wants to play, and he wants to play regularly, and he's put that at the top of his priorities. It's quite refreshing, actually.
It is interesting, Thirdy, that you mentioned the wage cuts, which are obviously being discussed with staff and that at Aberdeen. I mean, do you think, I don't know if I've seen some supporters saying it, and maybe with certain people within the club, again, we don't know. Do you think for some people there's maybe an uneasiness at seeing, you know, wage cuts being mentioned, but then, a new signing being made?
Well, it is. That's just human nature. If you're sitting there and your boss is telling you, look, we might need to pay you a little bit less because we're struggling. You know, by the way, here's a new star guy coming in a few days later. You must be looking, going, well, hold on a minute, how are we finding money for him? But I'm sure we will find out how the money has been found for Johnny in the weeks ahead, because for him to come in, I'm guessing here, you know, but I would think it's an educated guess that someone's going to have to go out to try and balance the books.
All very interesting then. Okay, I think that probably about does us for this week. Thanks, of course, to Rachel for joining myself, Paul and Callum today. Cheers.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ryan.
If you've got any questions or comments, as usual, you can email northerngoal@dctmedia.co.uk. We'll be back every Tuesday for as long as this goes on. Hopefully we'll have some football to talk about by August 1st. But until then, stay safe. Hope you loved the episode, and if you did, we'd be grateful if you could leave us a review or rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to pick up your copies of the Press and Journal and Evening Express every day for the best football writing and analysis in the North.